You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Chances are that you're using something with plastic in it at this very moment. We've come to take the material for granted, but some of the consequences of this were brought into horrific focus when 3.5 million tons of floating plastic debris was discovered in the Pacific Ocean. Captain Charles Moore is the person who discovered what has become known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Back in 1997, he's the founder and chief research coordinator of the Algalita Marine Research Organization, and he's written a new book for Avery Press called Plastic Ocean, in which he tells about his experiences documenting the cumulative effect of plastic on our world. What could be done about it? Welcome to our show, Captain Moore.
Thanks for having me.
What kind of captain were you back in 1997?
I was a skipper of a research vessel that was dismasted and entered a race in order to put that replacement mast under stress. So I was basically there to see if we could hold up under extreme conditions.
But you weren't looking for any plastic in the middle of the Pacific.
No, absolutely not. Matter of fact, people asked me as if it was an aha moment and I saw this plastic island out of the surface of the ocean, but it wasn't like that. It wasn't like that at all.
But what did you see at first? How long was it before you made a sense of what you were seeing?
You know, there's no log entry to note the date or the time that I made my first observation because, frankly, it wasn't remarkable. It would have been a shard of plastic, maybe a bottle cap, maybe just a piece of something floating by. It's just that I was in the doldrums, a very calm part of the ocean, where these little neutrally buoyant things were able to bob to the surface. And in 97, it was a big El Nino, so it was calm for over 1,000 miles. So
already 1,000 miles.
1,000 miles I could transit without being able to come on deck and not see one of these scraps.
And then it was learned that there are similar patches in other parts, in other oceans, aren't there?
Yeah, corresponding to the desert latitudes, the temperate latitudes, there are five of these subtropical gyres, North and South Atlantic, North and South Pacific, and the Indian Ocean.
Now, you have photographs of some of these things in your book, and you also brought some samples. This is something you scraped off of a beach in Hawaii?
Yeah, the southernmost beach in the United States, Kamilo Beach, is a collector beach. Ancient Hawaiians went there to find logs or bodies of people lost at sea. Now what they find is plastic trash, and the ocean, being very turbulent, grinds this material up and makes it part of the sand. So we now have a plastic sand beach in Hawaii.
Well, looking at it, I see mostly plastic, and some of the pieces are pretty big, and a little bit of sand. Is this just the way you scraped it off of the beach?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I've found areas where the plastic is a foot thick, and you've got to dig through it to get to the real sand.
Is this going to be the new sand, the sand of the future?
Unfortunately, looking at the beaches of Oregon, yes, it's already reached the Oregon shore.
So where does this junk come from? Is it just simply things that people have thrown overboard as ships have crossed the ocean?
Well, that's what we like to think. We think ocean equals ships. Therefore, pollution in ocean equals ship pollution. But as a matter of fact, all our rivers lead to the sea. The ocean is downhill from everywhere. And we really think the majority of it is coming from us on land.
The United States. Are we the worst offenders?
It's every urban area, whether it's Asia, Africa, Latin America, or the United States. We are contributing as citizens of the global economy, which is wrapped in plastic.
And what's happening with this plastic? Is it just swirling with the waves? You couldn't walk on this.
No, it's rare to find areas where the plastic is touching another piece of plastic. Mostly it's dispersed. That's why I call it, rather than a garbage patch, which is not my term, I call it a plastic soup.
Mm-hmm. So it's just a lot of water and then all of this stuff bobbing, and you say for 1,000 miles, has it grown since you first discovered it? Somebody else must have discovered it before you did, but not remarked on it.
Dr. Day and Ignell wrote a paper on their trawls throughout the North Pacific on the quantity of plastic that they found before my discovery, over 10 years before I discovered it, they'd already been looking for plastic in the ocean. It's just they didn't look in this particular garbage patch, this eastern garbage patch that I transited. And when I measured what was there, I found six times as much plastic as zooplankton, an average of 300,000 pieces per square kilometer. Today, on average, you're going to find double that in the number of pieces, and the ratio of plastic to plankton is six times worse, 36 to 1.
We will be posting a photograph of the new sand that you brought after our show today on our show page. But when you look at this plastic, you see a wide variety of plastic types. So does that mean this comes from all over?
It's non-point source pollution. So, yes, we've dealt with factory effluent. We've got a Nurdle bill in the state of California which prohibits these plastic factories from losing their feedstock, whether these plastic resin beads we call Nurdles. But we don't have the way to stop people from littering their trash, and that is ending up in the ocean.
So if I drop a plastic bottle into a sewer or into the Hudson River, is it likely to find its way into a plastic patch?
As long as the cap is on it. It turns out that the PET, the polyethylene terephthalate that our water bottles and soda bottles are made out of, sinks. So it needs to have some air in it, it needs to have the cap on it. But as soon as that cap cracks and allows the water to get in, or if it's lost with the cap off of it, it's going to go straight to the bottom. And we do see, I've seen underwater photos from 3,000 feet deep in the Mediterranean of mountains of plastic bottles on the seafloor.
So it's not just this floating soup. We have big plastic patches on the bottom of the sea, which would affect sea life, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. It changes the character of the community. People have remarked to me that all this plastic floating around is actually habitat and may increase the life in the ocean. And that's not uncommon for a pollutant, say a nutrient in the ocean, to increase the biomass of what's there. But these are not things we want. These are invaders, and the diversity of the ocean is compromised.
Would they attach themselves to coral reefs?
We've actually created a coral reef in the middle of the ocean. I've sampled coral reef fish, never seen before in the Central Pacific, living on coral that is growing on derelict fishing buoys and other crates of junk out in the middle of the ocean.
Well, I'm assuming that fish, when they're drinking water, are also taking in this plastic. Is that affecting them?
35% of the fish we caught out there had ingested plastic, and these plastics, as they float near the surface, accumulate our persistent organic pollutants. These oily pollutants like PCBs and DDE are floating near the surface. The plastic is a sponge for those pollutants, so it becomes a poison pill. And these poison pills then being ingested by these fish start that whole bioaccumulation cycle in which the big fish eat the little fish. They eat a lot of little fish, so however much is in the little fish gets concentrated in the bigger fish. Who do we want to eat? We want to eat the big guys. So we're getting a good dose of it ourselves.
And now we're hearing about salmon having this terrible virus. That's not connected to this, is it?
You know, aquaculture is where we're going to be getting, if not already, 50% of our seafood. In the near future, at least half of our seafood will come from aquaculture operations, and they require a lot of plastic to have these floats and nets and everything strung along the coastlines. And when a storm hits, the stuff breaks apart and gets out into the ocean. So a lot of the stuff we're finding out there is derelict gear from the aquaculture industry, which needs to really think through what it's doing to the habitat where it is. As you point out, concentrating these fish in these tight enclosures can lead to increased disease incidence.
Does this ever disintegrate? After all, plastic is made up of simple atoms and molecules. Does it break down to its original component parts?
Well, that was the marvelous discovery that was made by the early pioneers in polymer chemistry, was that you could take a simple natural compound and connect it to more of its mates and create something that wouldn't break down. This is the virtue of plastic, that it's something nature can't digest. It's an air barrier and a moisture barrier, and it doesn't biodegrade, not in any meaningful time scale. So we're talking centuries, if not millennia, for this stuff to go away.
It just breaks up into smaller and smaller pieces.
Absolutely. It's become micro plastic pollution. And microplastic pollution is affecting the very bottom of the food chain, these filter feeders, these non-discriminate web-feeding jellies and salps that filter enormous quantities of seawater are raking this stuff in, and they're being consumed by the fish. So it's happening at every trophic level, every feeding level from the tiny salps up to the great whales is either entangled in this stuff or eating it.
My guest is Captain Charles Moore, who's written with the help of Cassandra Phillips, Plastic Ocean, How a Sea Captain's Chance Discovery Launched a Determined Quest to Save the Oceans. It is published by Avery. You write, I wasn't the first to be disturbed about plastic trash in the ocean. I wasn't the first to study it, but maybe I was the first to freak out about it. Others weren't freaking out. I would think that if you're disturbed, you're going to be disturbed deeply about this, aren't you?
Well, I think science was disturbed in the sense that there was some motivator for Dr. Agnell and Dr. Day to get out there and see what was causing this proliferation of plastic in the ocean. They measured it, but their results appeared in scientific papers and in conferences, and they weren't really disseminated to the general public and didn't create an outcry for change. My vision is to be an agent of change. I think we're at a point in history where that's the key to our survival, is changing the way we got here, worked fine to get where we are. It's not going to take us where we need to go.
So there you were. You were out there on a research mission that had nothing to do with plastic. But then you went back to California. What did you do?
Well, I worked with scientists, basically, because the gold standard for getting your information into the public realm is to have a peer-reviewed scientific paper. Even though your reporters aren't scientists, they follow science, and they want to know what's really there. They don't want to get stuck with reporting a story that may turn out to be false, so the best they can do is get a peer-reviewed paper and follow that. Well, our goal was to get in the news, but to get in the news with the facts. And so we published those facts first, and that was the first goal.
And then you went back out a couple of years later. Had the situation changed much?
In 1999, our first survey, as I said, we found about 300,000 bits per square kilometer with a ratio of 6-to-1 plastic to plankton. We went back then again in the wintertime. This first survey was summer. So we went in the winter to see if that changed things, and then went back again the following summer. So we went 10 years on, and yes, it had changed. It had gotten worse. What we found was that it was 26-to-1 in the summer survey and 46-to-1 in the winter survey. So if we add those together, since we did the exact same sample design, the average came out 36-to-1. So yeah, it had gotten a lot worse. And then there was also this question of, well, will it be bad near the shoreline? So we did some work in the shore coastal zone. We looked at plastic plankton ratios in the water column near the bottom up at the surface, and we found actually a lot of, as you mentioned, these plastics hover near the bottom. The ones that aren't actually sitting on the bottom kind of hover near the bottom, and we took what we call an epibenthic sled that pulls a net just above the surface of the sea floor and found more plastic there in calm conditions than there was at the surface in the coastal zone.
Well, since fish are eating it, and we eat fish, does that mean we have plastic in our bodies?
You know, it's starting to be a concern, this lint in the drinking water. We're concerned with chemical pollution. That's what has been our focus, chemical and bacterial pollution of our resources. But it turns out that these microplastics, even though they're tiny polymer molecules, they're long. They're like 1,000 molecular weight plus, and these things don't really biodegrade. So you get these tiny, tiny submicroscopic polymers that aren't going away that are hanging around in our environment. They're hanging around in our water. They're hanging around in our sediments. And experiments done on filter feeders like mussels, they take these microfibers under 20 microns in length and translate them into the circulatory system. So it can go run around in the blood of a mussel. The stuff can run around in our blood, too.
I like steam mussels.
I like steam mussels, too. I think you want to eat the younger fish, the younger mussels. We developed a recipe for minnow stroni on the boat because if they had less time to eat up all this pollution, maybe they're less polluted.
My guess is Captain Charles Moore, who's a seafaring environmental researcher, an internationally recognized pollution expert and activist and founder of Algalita Marine Research Foundation. There was a Los Angeles Times multi-part article about the plastic plague in oceans, which featured Captain Moore, and it won a Pulitzer Prize in 2007. Now he's written a book with the help of Cassandra Phillips called Plastic Ocean, How a Sea Captain's Chance Discovery Launched a Determined Quest to Save the Oceans. It's published by Avery. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Captain Charles Moore, who's written with the help of Cassandra Phillips, Plastic Ocean, How a Sea Captain's Chance Discovery Launched a Determined Quest to Save the Oceans. It's published by Avery, and when Captain Moore is not writing books or going out to sea, he obviously is playing the drums, something he's just doing, in case you were wondering what that was all about. But you come from an oil family, don't you? Aren't you the grandson of a president of Hancock Oil?
That's right. I grew up in a family that was heavily involved in the oil industry and the chemical industry. My father was the president of Hancock Chemical Company, and my first job was a landscaper at a plant that took excess petroleum gases and turned them into elemental sulfur, made big piles of yellow stuff out in the back.
Is that what led you to become an environmentalist?
Oh, no, not at all. I had no consciousness of the problems involved in industrial production of chemicals and petroleum as a child.
What about the seafaring part? How did you become a captain?
My father was actually shanghaied onto a rum-running boat during the Prohibition, and he was a farm boy from Colorado, but that experience led him to want to have all his kids know what he called salt water. And he got a sailboat, and as a young child, I sailed to remote locations, and eventually the whole family sailed over to Hawaii.
A listener called in to say that he was in Alaska in the 1970s and saw plastic on the beaches there and assumed it was local. Could it have come from the patches we're talking about?
That's a good observation, actually, because the westerly winds along the Pacific coast make a lot of the floaters up back onto the shore in a quick time frame. So I've done a lot of investigation in Baja California, Mexico, of plastic debris there, and nearly all of it that I find is local stuff, oil cans from the Ponga fishermen pushed back up on shore. What we've got is the situation where the plastic from Southern California and Baja California has to be kind of neutrally buoyant, kind of has to hide under the surface of the water. If it has an appendage above the water surface, the winds prevailing onshore will push the debris back to the beach. So beach cleanups are an effective way of keeping stuff out of the ocean.
You said that this stuff never really breaks down completely. So do we have any idea of how old some of the objects in this soup are?
Actually, we have a record holder. The record holder is from a World War II aircraft that was shot down over the Pacific. We found a piece in an albatross stomach. This is a bird that is huge. It's a very big seabird, and the parents feed the chicks pretty good-sized stuff. They'll even feed them toothbrushes and cigarette lighters and a lot of bottle caps. And this one chick was fed part of a World War II aircraft, which had a number on it, and we were able to identify that number. So if we look, and let's call it 1941, say, that's 70 years that the number is still legible after having been floating around in the Pacific Ocean. So we're talking centuries here before anything of any significance is going to happen to the typical consumer plastics that are found floating in the ocean.
Is there anything positive about this? Could it provide some food for algae, for example?
Certainly, algae are beginning the consumption process. In soil, your typical consumer plastics will break down about 1 to 2% a year. So
that means we're talking thousands, maybe millions of years for it to break down totally.
Yeah, and the processes are much slower in the ocean than they are on land.
Doesn't salt water help break it down, or the sun?
The salt water and the sun certainly helps embrittle it. That's why we have this plastic soup. The particles all become brittle and break into bits. But that doesn't mean that the individual polymer has been biodegraded. That's a whole different process. Now, with regard to the issue of providing habitat for marine creatures, as I mentioned before, you may get a greater biomass of creatures out there living on this plastic, but you get less species diversity. If you have this biotic mixing where you take animals and give them a raft and let them go to all the points in the ocean, we could lose half of the species diversity in the ocean.
Isn't it killing off turtles because they mistake plastic bags for jellyfish?
Turtles are omnivorous. It's not just the bags. They eat the fragments, too. And the babies eat the fragments, and it blocks their digestive tract. We have an example of a small baby turtle that died because it couldn't eliminate. So, turtles are a real bad problem, as are these albatross. The seabirds are a bad problem. Now we're finding fish heavily impacted with this. So just about anywhere we look, it sort of follows the biblical admonition, seek and ye shall find. You know, anywhere we look, we're finding this stuff.
Is it just plastic, or is there other kinds of hazardous waste mixed in with this?
Well, certainly the Japanese tsunami released enormous logs, boats, houses. Any kind of household good, no matter what it's made out of, is now floating out in the Pacific, headed towards that coral reef reserve and declared by President Bush. The 1,500 miles of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands is now a national park, and it's under threat from these giant winter waves crashing those logs and other debris. But the stuff that's going to persist, the stuff that's going to be there for generations, is going to be the plastic.
My guest is Captain Charles Moore. His book, Plastic Ocean, How a Sea Captain's Chance Discovery Launched a Determined Quest to Save the Oceans, is published by Avery. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is this a matter for just the oceans, or is this going to have an impact back on the land?
Soil, you know, I'm an urban farmer. When I'm not sailing, I'm growing vegetables for a community-supported agriculture operation, and I make compost. And I started out in the 70s carefully removing every bit of plastic I could find from my compost. But it's got to the point where I wouldn't be able to work if I stopped and picked up every piece of plastic I saw, either in my compost or anywhere I walk, you know, on land. I see this stuff now. My eyes are tuned to it. And I would never get to my destination if I stopped and picked up all the trash. There's just too much of it there.
Does this help us in any way to understand the way the ocean works? Because I would think that despite all of the bad things we've been talking about, we would understand more about currents, just simple, and things of that sort, and temperatures, by watching what happens to this toxic soup.
It's a fantastic tracer. That's actually what got Dr. Ebesmeyer involved in it, was the rubber duckies, the sneakers, the Nike shoe spill. These are very cost-effective buoys, mini buoys, that you can follow in the ocean that do give you a clue. And I would really like to see them used in the subsurface research, you know. The ocean is kind of constructed in slabs of water. And so although it's all H2O, you know, with some salt in it, it doesn't act like a uniform body. It's very diverse. And certainly these plastics are inhabiting all these different layers, and we can learn a lot about them from the plastic. Nevertheless, I would gladly sacrifice that knowledge to know that the ocean was free from plastic.
A listener wonders about rain, because rainwater is often picked up from the oceans. Is it picking up plastic as well? Are we being rained on by plastic?
I wonder if that's really happening, because plastic is a little bit heavier, a little bit denser. It doesn't have a gaseous phase. So I don't know that as water evaporates in a gaseous phase that the plastic would go along with it. However, once it hits the ground, once that rain hits the ground, it can very quickly entrap plastics, and that's where the problem is.
Well, why haven't governments been getting more involved in this story?
Non-point source pollution is a real problem, because it's our food delivery system, it's our product delivery system, it's the lubricant of globalization. You want to push for growth in the economy, you can't push for diminution of plastic, because plastic is what facilitates this proliferation of quick product production.
But we still are concerned about what happens in the oceans. Is this a matter of we're only concerned, let's say, the United States or any other country, with the waters that are within our jurisdiction?
Well, certainly the 200-mile territorial waters give us an area where focus is put by the nations of the world. The International Maritime Organization is a division of the United Nations designed to deal with problems outside that 200-mile limit, and they did create MARPOL Annex 5, which prohibited the dumping of plastics anywhere in the ocean in the 1980s. But enforcement is very difficult. We can't get cops to write littering tickets. They don't want to appear in court on a cigarette butt thrown out the window. So, you know, it's much tougher to get any kind of enforcement in the sea.
Is this true all over the world? Are Europeans better about this than we are, or the Japanese?
Different cultures are making different inroads in different aspects. The Germans, being materials-oriented, are very good at recycling. They have every train station has a four-unit bin. You know, separation at the source is really the key to successful resource recovery.
And they have a very limited coastline.
Yeah, well, nevertheless, it's... the fact that things run off from wherever you are into the ocean that matters. So collecting it in Denver, Colorado is just as important as collecting it in San Diego, California.
What can you tell us about the Japanese study conducted by the Tokyo University of Agriculture and Technology?
Yeah, Dr. Hideshige Takada has started the International Pellet Watch, and what he's done is to use these pre-production plastic pellets which escape from the factories, these little plastic resin beads, as a marker for marine pollution. It turns out there's a relationship between, say, what a mussel would filter out of the water and what these plastic pellets filter out of the water. So he can tell you the kind of pollutants that are in the water that these pellets wash up from if you collect them on the beach. So now we've got a graph of the levels of pollution in different areas of the world because volunteers have sent him these little plastic pellets off the beaches. He's found that they can collect pollutants from the ocean up to a million times their level in the surrounding seawater, so they're very good collectors of our persistent organic pollutants.
Isn't another one of the problems that the fishing industry relies heavily on plastic?
Absolutely. And
with no intention of polluting?
Well, with a grain of salt, you see, because fishing gear has gotten so inexpensive now, Taiwanese fishermen, and the price of fish has gone up so high, they'll throw their nets over to make more room for their catch. So they'll come and get brand new nets every time they go out. They'll catch a bunch of fish, stack them on deck or put them in the hold, and then wherever they would have had all these nets stored, they want to have a little extra room, they'll jettison the net. So, cheap fishing gear is used artisanally, made out of plastic, meaning a little guy will get out there with his net and it'll get, maybe subject to some regulation. He'll run away, but the net is left there, so the enforcement officers aren't going to know how to pull his net in. They're just going to chase him away. So a lot of these derelict nets get out in the ocean from little guys running away from enforcement.
Listeners seem to be very concerned about all the plastics getting into the food chain, the PCBs. One person wants to know about all of the fish oils that we are told by our doctors to consume.
Yeah, certainly you want to make sure when you're consuming your EPA, your fish oil, that it is certified to be PCB free.
Can they do that?
Yeah, you can check with the lab that's producing this stuff and make sure that they test for those kind of pollutants. You want to make a very concerted effort to look into what you're consuming, especially even your bottled water. You know, Dr. Ullman over in Germany wrote a paper on the fact that the snails he put into bottles of bottled water made twice as many eggs as his controls. There's phthalates leaching from these polyethylene terephthalate bottles that are bioactive. They act like estrogens. And, you know, pregnant women and young children need to be aware of the fact that drinking bottled water out of plastic may be affecting their endocrine system.
Andy, one of our listeners, left this question. I get the vast quantities of plastic involved, but can the ocean be cleaned?
No, I do a calculation in the book of how long it would take, and it's in the thousands of years. 40% of the world ocean is these subtropical gyres. They all accumulate our trash. That's 40% of the world ocean is equivalent to the entire land surface of the world. So these are accumulation zones. And apart from that, the stuff leaving the shore is on a highway to these accumulation zones. So it's polluted as the stuff is moving to these places where it comes to rest.
We'd have to put filters out, off of all of our shorelines.
Well, we are doing that in L.A. We're putting filters on all the storm drains. We call them catch basin inserts, and they are effective. This is the way that we get to a zero trash, which is the law now in the state of California. So,
is that one of the laws that you have pushed for? Because you have been made efforts to bring about new laws. How? What kind of response have you gotten from politicians?
Well, our seminal paper on the plastic and plankton in the North Pacific Gyre was quoted in the what they call the total maximum daily load, the trash TMDL for the Los Angeles River. And so it has made a difference. We now have laws in place to prohibit the factories from discharging their feedstocks, these nurdles, these plastic resin beads. We have laws in place to ban plastic bags. We have laws in place to ban polystyrene containers, which are a big problem for the ocean. So, yes, I think the work is making a difference, both legislatively and in the minds of our readers.
But you keep on going out on new journeys and seeing a worse and worse situation.
There's nothing like firsthand contact with this phenomenon to get people galvanized. So I take as many people to this area as possible. We've got a voyage coming up to the debris tsunami field. So that's an opportunity, too.
And should we be as concerned on the East Coast? How big is the gyre in the Atlantic Ocean?
Actually, it runs coast to coast. It runs from, it's more dispersed in the Atlantic and the North Atlantic. So the Sargasso Sea, that phenomena that we see of accumulation of plastic, occurs all the way over to Europe.
Captain Charles Moore has written, with the help of Cassandra Phillips, a book called Plastic Ocean, How a Sea Captain's Chance Discovery Launched a Determined Quest to Save the Oceans. It's published by Avery. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. ¶¶